Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goals are to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully. Our purpose is to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit. And at this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual as well as the collective level. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with movers and shapers who've created the new medicine and other holistic approaches to individual and collective healing, and are still contributing wisdom and practical guidance. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery to help integrate the wisdom our guest brings us. So, once again, it's time to relax, focus your mind, and open your heart to the power within. Welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. And our guest today is Fred Luskin, who we met quite a while ago, and then we ran into each other again just recently. Fred is, if you haven't been living under a rock, you know that Fred has become very well known for his work in forgiveness, his scientific work in forgiveness, and who is still working as a senior consultant in health promotion at Stanford University, where he teaches people how to manage their stress and live lives of greater satisfaction. He's been on national television, he's been all over the media, and has written a whole group of books, including the very famous Forgive for Good, and then Forgive for Love. So, I'd like to welcome you here to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Welcome, Fred.
Hey, thank you so much, Emma.
And I guess our first meeting then was what, about 15 or 20 years ago?
It was over 20 years ago.
Oh my goodness!
I was a graduate student at Stanford, and I think you did some kind of either adjunct work or teaching or something for our program. It was probably 20 years ago in the mid-90s.
Yes. Yeah.
Life goes by.
And I remember talking to you after class, and then I didn't see you for 20 years.
It's exactly right. I know.
So I'm glad that we've had a chance to connect again. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So what is the... what is the elevator speech when people say, what's this forgiveness stuff, and what's a guy trained in the elite academic institutions doing talking about forgiveness? Isn't that like Jesus's work?
You know, I get less of that question now than I did, but I remember about almost 15 years ago, I was trying to get an interview with the Palo Alto Weekly, you know, which is a very small local paper that will do almost anything to, you know, report on or accommodate Stanford. And I remember saying, you know, we have this new project and we'd really like some help in publicizing it. And I remember getting like pushed down the food chain because nobody could really figure out, like, why would one of the world's great universities be studying forgiveness? And I remember, you know, because I think I had other contacts with them where I'd speak to the editor or, you know, the managing director and all this stuff. And so they sent this basically to an intern who had no idea why she was being asked to interview, but she had nobody to down push it towards. But after about a few minute talk, like, you could see some interest dawning on her, which is, oh, this isn't just about science. This isn't just about, like, technology. This is about what human beings deal with on a regular basis. Like, how do they deal with their disappointment in other people, and how do they deal with their own flawed nature? and that's when the light bulb went on for her about the need for forgiveness, that we're dealing with that question, like, regularly.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So what did you tell her when you finally got a chance to get the interview?
Well, if I could tell you one other story, I think this might explain it.
Okay.
At about the same time, the major TV stations in San Francisco became intrigued by the fact that we had a forgiveness project at Stanford. And one of them called me up and said, why are you studying this stuff? So I said, well, do me a favor. Just go around your newsroom and ask in your newsroom, does anybody here have a grudge or resentment or a problem with anybody else here? So the guy, hung up the phone, called me back, less than 5 minutes later and said, Fred, everybody here hates each other. And he was like, wow, I didn't really pay attention to the undercurrent of resentment. And literally that prompted him to do a story on our forgiveness work, which led to an enormous amount of publicity in the Bay Area. And I was just laughing at that.
Yeah. So what we have a situation where, I've made this point many times, where there's two fundamental ways you can look at the world, and one is analytically, where you break things down, look for opposition, differences, polarity, and the other is a unitive way, where you look for the oneness, you look for larger patterns that unite seemingly disparate aspects into a single whole. And that, of course, opens the door to the healing process. And so much of our world is run on that theory that you don't need road manners if you're 18-wheeler. And we see polarity all around. And that what we're missing is a sense of unity, a sense of how we can see ourselves as all being a part of something larger. So in this particular case, here you had an office full of people who are really, really disliking each other. So using that as a starting point, how does forgiveness enter into that kind of situation? How do we think about it?
If I use your model, what came to me is that the healthiest people are those who can do both. That they can fully articulate, like, the grievances from, like, the individual's point of view, that they can, they can feel their feelings, that they can protect themselves, that they can distinguish self from other, and break down the world into the components that aren't working and need some attention. But the healthy people don't stay in that place. Like, they may start in analytical right, wrong, division, whatever it is, yin-yang consciousness. But then they recognize its limitations. And they open up to a resolution which can never come from that scattered consciousness. The resolution comes from a more unitive consciousness, but the problem articulation is from the other consciousness. And forgiveness is one of those names for that, which is when you go from you know, this hurt me, and I'm the center of the universe, and I'm sitting here from my perch of judgment and making everything wrong, then that resolves itself with a different kind of understanding. And that's how I would hold your, you know, the language that you use.
Uh-huh.
From the work that I do, you know, it's pretty much, I refer to that as the process of grief, that, you know, you become hugely aware of the suffering and the inherent danger in the world and the, like, the relentless selfishness of yourself and other people, which are all true. But you don't stay mired in that. But there, at the moment of insult, you know, grieving, feeling those wounds and articulating what's wrong can be a healthy process. And so the only point I'm trying to make is, generally speaking, the people that I've seen who go through this well are those who are good at articulating and getting support for their pain and their idiosyncratic point of view of how what the world has failed them, but don't stay there.
Uh-huh. And so, in order to make it from this sort of polarized way of looking at things and hating and resenting and being jealous and being envious and so forth, what do you find is most useful in terms of at least giving people the insight that there could be a better way?
The two easiest practices that I have found are just in the moment, simple stress management practices to, like, force people to relax, like to just, you know, lower the level of adrenaline running through their system and, like, harmonize some of their brain function or whatever you want to call it, or just chill. And that chilling has the capacity to, like, relax certain, like, harshnesses, but I think it also changes the physiology a little bit so that it's possible for them to entertain other experiences. And the more nudgy thing is to remind them of the good in their life, like, for people mired in, like, this really stunk, and this issue is just so bad, and nobody should ever endure something like this. There are so many simple gratitude practices or appreciation practices or just noticing the abundance around them that allow them to start putting even the worst wounds into some kind of perspective.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And do you find it's difficult for people to release those resentments and to understand how it benefits them to let go of that polarization and resentment?
When I started teaching, I used a lot more science than I use now. I remember, you know, almost 20 years ago, feeling much less secure in what I was doing and in certain the power of you know, basic kindness to make a difference. And so I used to show lots of, like, you know, things about heart rhythm and how resentment does this, this, and this. And that was helpful. More so for men than for women, but it was helpful that they'd look at this and say, oh, wait a second. I don't want to be, you know, shooting this chemical into my body or disrupting this rhythm for 12 years now just because my mother was a bad mother. Like, you know, I don't want to suffer in that way. And that's still in all my presentations, that, you know, just reflect a bit that your anger and your self-righteous judgments carry a cost. And that cost is very much, like, related to your physical well-being, which is the most tangible thing that people move on to. And that has a very simple and powerful effect of catching their attention. other thing that almost always catches their attention is when you ask them to have the experience of feeling good about something. So, you know, just take 30 seconds out and remember somebody who was kind to you after spending, you know, 17 hours talking about somebody who wasn't. And just notice how different they feel. You know, so when you feel that difference, then you have something to ask yourself, well, which state of being do I want to be in? You know, it's, you know, there, I have some control over this. It's not just that the world is a terrible place, but I can put my attention and my mind in different places and to some degree create a different experience. And then I even suggest that the intelligence inside of them of abundance or goodwill or kindness can be brought to bear on the bad situation. Like you can bring a gentler part of you or a more compassionate part of you just to access it. And those are about as gentle a ways as I have found to enter the discussion with people.
Uh-huh. Well, I have another question, Fred. I'd like to know a little bit about how you got into doing what you're doing. Were you one of these little kids who at the age of four was running around saving snails and insects that had managed to wander inadvertently into the house? Or how did you come to see the world this way and to make it the focus of your work?
No, I was probably at four, like setting fire to snails. That would be my guess. You know, if there was a snail post office, like my picture was there. not at all. I did, though, in like late adolescence, become interested, as so many people of, you know, that generation did, in yoga and meditation. And I started doing yoga, God, when I was 16 or 17 years old, and, you know, have had a practice in that, you know, for 40 years.
Uh-huh.
So yoga, you know, loosened me up, you know, just stretching and bending and breathing loosened me up. And then I started to meditate, and I became a vegetarian, which I think had a huge impact on my consciousness. That I became a vegetarian because of, you know, health reasons. And then I recognized after a while that, like, the health reasons didn't matter as much to me anymore. That, you know, I wasn't going to die if I ate a hamburger. And, you know, excuse me, I became a little less certain that you had to be absolute in that. Like, it was very clear to me that a plant-based diet is what human beings are supposed to eat. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you eat that for 90% of the time. I don't think anybody totally knows what the other parts of it are. So that started to mellow. But what became more obvious to me is how wrong it was to kill animals, that unless, you know, I was in absolute dire need, participating in a culture that killed billions of animals every year was a horrific violence and a unnecessary creation of suffering. And that altered me. Like, that kind of responsibility for both the creation of suffering and the easing of suffering, I think, had a transformative impact on me. And I started slowly, you know, to become a different kind of person, you know, with different values and perceptions and things like that. And all along, I kept up, you know, a meditation practice. And over time, you know, I became more and more interested in the effects of meditation and what did it mean to have a spiritual practice, and But I also was interested, I mean, if you're asking where this forgiveness thing came from, you know, I like science, and I believe that if I had to trust somebody's intuition about something, or a randomized clinical trial with 3,000 people, I'm going with the randomized clinical trial. And that became like the genesis for what I did, because in the 90s when I started, there was that beginning sense that like religion and spirituality and science didn't have to be at odds with each other, you know, that they were complementary processes exploring the world and trying to figure out what the heck the rules of this place were. And so what I became interested in is, can you teach some very simple spiritual qualities and measure their effect? I mean, it was an incredible simplistic notion, but like, what, you know, what if you help people become kinder or more loving or compassionate or gentler or patient? And the one that I chose was forgiveness. You know, it's just that was where I started, and the effects were so dramatic, and the impact so global on people, you know, science, in from a scientific point of view, that it was a keeper. You know, it was like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, this is, the world should know about this.
Right. And so you became kind of a prophet of forgiveness. And I was
I don't know if you remember, you know, Larry Dossey's early work on prayer.
Sure.
And he would say, you know, if prayer was a drug, you know, the whole world would be beating a path to his door.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he had some studies, and you know, prayer is free. You know what I mean? And it, you know, everybody can do it, and it doesn't harm anybody. You know what I'm getting at.
And right.
And nobody was interested, and he was struck by that very profoundly as the, you know, the almost the ferocious money making needs of our medical system. And I felt the same way with our psychology system when I started to research forgiveness, that therapists were not that interested, that, you know, that there was this sense of, well, if you forgive people, then, you know, you're not really holding them accountable. And don't you need to work through, you know, the fact that your mother didn't love you when you were nine? You know, like, and I thought the answer to that is no. You know, sometimes you can just forgive her. And so I had a similar experience, but it triggered my, like, a little bit more fire, you know, that, wait a second, this is wrong. Like, these are entrenched interests just trying to hold on to their turf, not necessarily trying to help people. And that triggered in me an increased passion for what I was doing.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, I was thinking about the about forgiveness and a sort of parallel concept which has to do with, admitting or taking responsibility. And we can see it on a personal level, I think, you know, very, very easily. People who don't want to take responsibility for what they do. You can go to court any day and just see a long line of people who don't want to take responsibility for their role in whatever happened. Or on a grander scale, we see the Turks not willing to take responsibility for what happened in Azerbaijan, and the leader of Japan is not very interested in acknowledging the rape of Nanking, and or the United States and being willing to acknowledge what it has done to the rest of our hemisphere. And even if 50 or 100 or 150 years have passed, people still, I mean, what's so wonderful about Germany, that was the exception. Germany has been amazing in taking responsibility. but we don't want to take responsibility, and therefore the people of Azerbaijan are still angry with the Turks, and the Chinese are still, you know, pretty angry with the Japanese. And it seems like some sort of parallel going on. And in order for forgiveness to happen, or let's say forgiveness is a lot easier when someone says, I realize that I really messed you up there, and I feel some remorse, and I'd like to try to pay you back for that, and I have plans for how I'm not going to let that happen again in the future. It's really much easier to forgive someone when they're coming from that point of view. What have you found in that sphere, or have you thought about it that way?
Well, you know, what you just described is what the research suggests is the heart of a true apology. Not a fake apology, not a self-serving apology, but a true apology. That a true apology involves, it was my bad, not yours. That it wasn't the problem that you took too much offense. The problem was I did bad. I recognize that my bad directly hurt you, and I feel for that. And if there's something that I can do to make it better, I would like to. Those are the essences of a true apology. And there is good research that facilitates forgiveness. So you are absolutely right. The place that I would also articulate, though, is that people don't take responsibility for their flamboyant reactions. That, like, if something bad happens to me and I stay upset for 11 years or 6 years, that's not only the fault of the offender or the insult. It's my own inability to adjust to life and to adapt and to make peace and to grow and to take responsibility for how I feel. Like, it works in both directions. And the place that I work on is that second one, that, you know, you may never get your grandmother who's dead to apologize to you. And since people often see things so differently and are so self-serving in their points of view, grandma may see it as your point that you were a two-year-old pain in the ass, so she had to hit you. You know, it's very difficult to get people out of their self-centeredness. And so the forgiveness work often goes directly at the responsibility for nurturing oneself, for calming oneself down, for seeing the world with compassion, because everybody gets hurt. It's not personal. It's like this is a universal human experience. And the other piece that we teach is, you know, the very simple truth that you can change your story about how you describe the situation. And that change in story is the actual forgiveness. You can't go at that directly, but your issue about it is maintained by a story that where somehow you are a victim of something, and then you release that through changing the story. Like, you no longer orient the schema around a certain need to be victimized. The story changes, and your physiology changes because of the story change, and so we remind people to practice different stories, like to actively try to construct different narratives to see how they work and see how they feel, and to help people get off being addicted at some level to one narrative. Mm-hmm. So you hear my answer, like, yeah. Yes, you're right, and there's a whole nother level of not taking responsibility.
Yeah. And so what you're inviting people to do is to engage their imagination, which is the essence of their creativity. I think that people, we don't realize how powerful, how incredibly powerful our imaginations are. If we did, we would use our imagination. Certainly, I think to pray is to use your imagination. I mean, you have to imagine that there's someone or something that somehow hears those prayers, and you're already stepping into another realm. But I think I was just reviewing some of R.D. Lang's work the other day, and I ran across a quote of his that said that in our early childhood and in our infancy, that we're in a hypnotic trance, and the trance that's begun at that time patterns our experiences for the rest of our lives and our behavior. And if we were to grow up in a family where we had unending love, and if we were treated like something that was incredibly precious, in a wise and sensible way, but if we live surrounded by that love of family and maybe the whole village for that matter, that you have a very different world from one where you know, by the time you're one, you've seen your father slap your mother around a half dozen times, and you've seen your mother too drunk to be able to walk. And when you finally make it out on the street, you've got the duck bullets, or even an environment that's not even that tough. But you know, maybe a mother who's depressed and doesn't really hold you. There's a trauma, what I call spiritual trauma, that happens at that moment, and we don't really know who we are. And in my mind, healing really requires two phenomena. One is a sense of true identity, and number two is the creation of a balance or a homeostasis around that fulcrum. And if you don't know who you are, you can't know who you are if you're busy running from all of the dangerous things in your environment. So you grow up with this feeling, a deep feeling of insecurity. You know, as a side remark, I recently had a little journey down to Cuba, and I just went there to talk with the man in the street and just met tons of people, and they were so warm. And they were, there was something different about them. I gradually began to realize that there, everybody has a roof over their head. It may not be a very pretty roof, but they have a roof over their head. And secondly, if you're hungry, there are stands you can go up to and get food any place. You're not going to starve to death. And if you get sick, you do have free health care. And you have 100% literacy there. And so I think of what people there don't have, that grinding sense of fear that we have here, that we won't be able to pay the mortgage next month, or working for another 10 years at a job that you absolutely hate because you have insurance coverage there and so forth. So there's that fear, that lack of security inside. And of course, these are the people that we find in our families and our businesses, and that we find running our country and our planet. And they're not coming from an awareness of the potential. They're coming from the fear that someone's going to get them. There's a sort of a paranoia inside and a selective viewing of the world. So whatever is the most negative way to take the statement you just made, I will take that one, because if it's the law of the jungle, you know, if it's a stick, that's a lot more important than if it's a carrot. But what you're doing, and I think what I try to do in my work as well, is to give people a way out of that, which is the imagination, which is imagine that things are different, and by so doing, you actually come a little bit closer to the truth of who a person is, and you open up that creative potential that's within them.
You know, the one thing I would not disagree with you, but I think you minimize how much people use their imagination to construct negative, painful scenarios.
Oh, absolutely.
That those attitudes are not just created from difficult childhood experiences or anything in the past, but they're maintained by almost a vigilant negativity.
That's right. And that kind of, I think people, don't go in with an intention. Let me see how terrible I can make this situation seem. And I think that's the problem. Our imaginations have gotten out of our control. But when you tell people, hey, you can make your health better, you can make your life better, and you can earn more money in your organization, if you're willing to intentionally use your imagination and imagine that there are other scenarios, and even positive scenarios.
Well, and you don't even have to just go to imagination. You can go to reality. One of the things I thought of when you were talking about, like, the Cubans is they have so, from the way you described it, have so much less greed and avarice that they don't need 14-room houses, and they're not desperate for their kids to get to Stanford. So they have so much less desperate grasping, which creates a lot of the misery that we see here.
Yes, yes. And so much of what we do in order to have that 14-room house is we have to be willing to abuse other people.
There's no question that's true.
And to take advantage of others.
And to bring this back to forgiveness, one of the things that I have seen is the real damage of unforgiveness is not like the modest health consequences, because there are some modest health consequences of not forgiving. But the biggest damage that I've seen from not forgiving is that people use the fact that they've been mistreated as an excuse to mistreat other people. That's the biggest damage that I have seen, that because my mother didn't love me, because my last husband was a terrible human being, because my boss fired me, it's okay that I mistreat somebody else. And that's the biggest damage that I see. And the whole world operates on that principle.
Yes. Yes.
And so it's in that way that I think forgiveness is so important. It doesn't really matter if you forgive grandma. You know, it's like, so fine. If you don't want to forgive her, don't forgive her. But the issue is, do you then use that wound or that space that is, like, corroded and take that pain and then need some displacement of that pain to make you feel better or to feel more in sync? That's the danger. And that goes unexpressed and unseen all over the place. You know, you see it in families, you see it in cultures, you see it in religions. They all fight each other because they've been wounded in some way, and it's okay then to hurt back.
And then to be in a kind of denial about what you're doing to someone else, denial allows you to go ahead and to take advantage of that. Slavery comes to mind, where you feel so ripped off by the world that it's okay for you to use other people or to steal from them or embezzle or cheat or lie, all those kinds of things. And so I think we cling to that anger. We cling to that resentment because it then enables us to gain some advantage on the other side without seeing that we're doing it.
That's what I believe. And that's why I believe forgiveness is so resisted, because it enables a mistreatment of others. And if we didn't have that, then to some degree we would have to see our own culpability and become a lot more responsible, and that's what we resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some of what we do when we teach is that denial busting. I remember saying, in different ways, this is when I started it. I was just trying stuff out. But I remember, like, there were a group of people who, a lot of the people there had husbands or wives who had had affairs on them. And so that was their issue. And I would say, you know, I get it that it's really painful. I certainly don't want my partner to have an affair, but like the affairs that you're talking about, they happened 3 years ago and 5 years ago and 7 years ago. And that doesn't explain why you're still talking about it. That right now, it could be in the state of California, a million people are engaged in an affair as we talk, you know, because the percentages are very high. You know, I was just making up a number. But right now, there could be a million married couples cheating, and you don't care about any of it. So there's something else going on. You know, there's something else that you're getting out of this. And I've always wanted to dance with that because the denial keeps it going. Like they don't. If you don't look at your own stuff, then it's all the problem of what the world did to you.
And then that'll result in your mistreating other people, and that kind of keeps the cycle of violence going, doesn't it?
That's what I think. And I think that's what got interrupted in me a bit when I became a vegetarian and really thought about it. That, you know, just being a vegetarian didn't make me think about anything. But years later, when I learned more and I became less dogmatic, and I started to, you know, really recognize, you know, it's no big deal if you have a piece of chicken. But it was that I don't want to commit violence that became so tangible to me. And I think it's that's such a difficult thing for each of us to grasp, is the violence we're doing, not just so much what was done to us.
Yes. I'd like to pause for just a moment and remind our listeners that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which comes to you as a result of the work of our hardworking team here. Jesse Churchill, my daughter, Aaron, Susan, and all the folks here. And this is a publicly supported program. We depend on your support. Your purchase of our self-healing products at drmiller.com will help. You can also support us by telling your friends, clients, patients, and those on your mailing list about what we're doing here and about what we have to offer. So please visit our multimedia website, drmiller.com, where you will find my videos, archives of all these conversations, and including a couple of great conversations with Larry Dossey, who I had the great honor of introducing to the world of holistic medicine back in the late 60s and early 70s. But in case you've missed any of these, you'll find them there. There's a plethora of information on mind-body medicine, personal transformation, and the transpersonal perspective. If you click on the word store in the menu, you'll find a collection of audio and video programs featuring deep relaxation and guided imagery meditations for healing your body, balancing and invigorating your emotions, overcoming bad habits, and achieving peak performance. And if you sign up for our free newsletter, you get two free gifts. One is an imagery, and another is a free copy of my most recent book, Our Culture on the Couch, 7 Steps to Global Healing. And a special thank you to those who've been supporting us all the way along. We really appreciate it. Today's guest is Fred Luskin. How can people efficiently find out more about you, Fred?
The testament to my work is the two books that I've written on forgiveness, Forgive for Good, about, you know, general forgiveness, and Forgive for Love, about forgiveness within couples. You know, I have a website, learningtoforgive.com, which, you know, gives out some of the research that we've done and the basics of the methodology. You know, I'm not a total public presence, but the books are the work, you know, that distilled what we learned from basically being, you know, somewhat pioneers in this. Of
mm-hmm. That's right.
How do you make a science of forgiveness?
Yes.
Right? You know, that's, how do you standardize to some degree a secular methodology, prove that it works, and then, you know, report back on it.
Mm-hmm. You were speaking about becoming a vegetarian and deciding that you didn't want to do violence to animals anymore. And that kind of leads us into what I wanted to ask you about has to do with the transpersonal aspects of forgiveness. Because here, rather than, you know, looking into how you can have a delicious bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. you're thinking about, you know, I'm caring about those animals. I'm caring about the pigs and the billions of animals that are slaughtered. Say a little bit about the transpersonal aspects of forgiveness.
You know, that's a harder one for me to talk about because the way I see it is that anger, resentment, bitterness, self-centeredness are the natural products of a certain consciousness, which you described before, of a certain black and white, us, them, way of being in the world. And so out of that consciousness, all sorts of problems emerge. There are techniques that alter that consciousness, that make it less reflexively selfish, less antagonistic, more accepting of what is, and then even more kind-hearted towards everything. So, but I don't really know what transpersonal means, and I don't really have a schema for that. What I do know is that inside of us is a vast kind of intelligence that's untapped, and it can be tapped through practice and intention. And when that is tapped, our perceptions and our way in the world alter. Like they just what becomes normal changes. And it leads people to choose things that are like kinder to the self and other, but less self-centered is a big piece of it. Less just self-protective, not just self-aggrandizing. That the perspective broadens, and it's not just about me at the center. So I think that's some description of it, but that's my way of languaging it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a, as we lower the boundaries and maybe through some relaxation or meditation or lowering the level of stress being that activation that we have because the paleo cortex thinks that we're about to be pounced on by a saber-toothed tiger, that as we lower that tension, we're able to experience a kind of empathy. Maybe our mirror neurons kick in, and we're able to feel empathy and more than that, even compassion.
That's exactly the way I see it.
Uh-huh. And so there's a relationship that we begin to perceive that perhaps wasn't clear to us while we were holding on to our resentments.
And that was always there. And was always possible and imminent and latent and only limited by our consciousness.
And as we're more willing to allow our consciousness to expand, which means that we're able to embrace more possibilities, then that naturally leads us to discover that the true spaciousness of who we are as individuals, and that seems also then to lead to including that spaciousness and the miracle that is each other person, maybe each other animal too.
Well, there are. I've met some teachers who have told me that. I mean, I've had people tell me they don't agree with the way I teach this from all sorts of points of view. But the one that has intrigued me is people who have taught forgiveness a little bit from the point of view that, like from the spirit point of view, nothing actually happened. That, you know, there really was no insult. There was nothing that's just a small artifact of consciousness. And while I can grasp that a little bit, one of the reasons that the work that I've done has been effective, you know, in terrible situations in the world, is, again, we try to honor that consciousness of pain and suffering and simply suggest to people that you don't want to stay stuck in it. It's not that that consciousness is wrong or inadequate, but it's one that will limit you if it goes on for too long. So it's like an emergence from that consciousness. But I have chosen to do that to be welcomed into medical schools and law schools and, you know, like to a little bit meet people where they are.
And I believe that's exactly the way it has to be done. It's the same way I do if I'm doing therapy or consulting work, is to, people have their story. And if you go and saying, okay, first off, you're wrong. Now I'm going to tell you what the truth is. I think if you go in and say, I hear your story, I see your pain, and I totally understand it. Now, where are we going to go from here?
That's it. And the choice is theirs, not ours.
That's right. So how are we going to get the leaders of the world to buy into this?
We did some work, it's a while ago now, almost 13 years ago, with people from Northern Ireland, from both sides of the conflict, and you know, they had family members murdered, and we taught them to forgive, you know, Catholics and Protestants. And we were struck by the ferocity with which the communities used the murders of the individuals for their community goals. That, you know, each time there was violence against someone in the community latched onto it and said, well, this is why we hate the other side. We can't trust them. They're always doing this, this, and this. And they treated a family member who forgave or didn't want to align with that as a traitor to their cause.
Mm.
That you're not really with us. You know, if you're not willing to let your son be martyred, then you know, you're not with us. And that was a very sobering realization for me to sit with, that it's way more than just how are we going to get leaders to do this. It's a dense consciousness of tribal wounding and vengeance that the world operates under. And I mean, if you were going to ask me what we could do, the few things I can think of are to elevate models, heroic models of people who do good, you know, like not movie stars and football players, but people who are really kind and promote them and, really teach people like the essences of secular meditation and, you know, make that part of our school systems and, you know, so that everybody has some capacity to downshift their nervous system and to address the rampant materialism and greed with some more gratitude so that the nervous system isn't as triggered all the time by longing. I mean, I think it's more basic than and more deeply entrenched in people's collective nervous system than just will leaders, what will they offer? But I'm in the front line, so I may not have that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a good one, and I think it is important that that somehow it needs to happen on that individual level, and that maybe as leaders emerge who understand that, as opposed to the kinds of and leaders, and I say leaders in quotes, that we've seen running the show in Washington and around the world. If we begin to see people who maybe understand some of what people like Gandhi or Jesus or Martin Luther King understood, people are still blown away by what they were able to accomplish. Yeah, but, you know, how about if we look and see how they looked at the world? And there was a similar way they looked at the world, where they saw the connection instead of the difference.
You know, I remember just a year ago seeing the film about Cesar Chavez,
mm-hmm.
and just being struck by what a remarkable human being he was.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, he had this deep vision and deep passion for his work, and yet, you know, he wasn't a revenge seeker. He wanted to be nonviolent. I mean, it was just remarkable to see a human being, like, with that level of awareness and self-control and power, and it inspired me.
Yeah, and it's wonderful, all of those, Cesar Chavez and Gandhi and Jesus, there's nothing I've done that anyone couldn't do if you really put your mind and your heart to it. And I sure hope as many people as possible learn about some of the things that we're talking about. And I'd like to thank you so much for the really seminal work that you've done in this field and really put forgiveness on the scientific map. Thanks so much, Fred.
Hey, you're very welcome, Emmett. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
You've been listening to Dr. Fred Luskin from Stanford University. And you can learn more about his work by going to learningtoforgive.com. Check out his books, Forgive for Good, A Proven Prescription for Health and Happiness, and also Stress-Free for Good. You can learn more about my work, again, by going to drmiller.com. You can come to facebook.com/AskDrMiller and join our conversation there. Or you can just email me directly at drmiller@drmiller.com. So until we meet again next time, remember, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you'd like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com, locate your desired program, and use the promo code CONVERSATIONS2015 when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.